This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Food Friday, we meet the self-proclaimed cheese preacher who's with us to share great news about all things cheesy and tell us about her new book, Cheese, Sex, Death. First, a new report finds that the last two decades have been the warmest on record here in Wisconsin. That warming is happening the most quickly in the winter, and the shift is affecting winter activities and ways of life. As Danielle Kading reports, that includes the American Birkebeiner, North America's largest cross-country ski race, which will be held this weekend in northern Wisconsin.
With the sun shining overhead, Hayward's Stephen Mank skied along loops near the Berkey Trailhead as temperatures hovered far below freezing in Cable last Thursday.
I haven't missed the Berkey since 1985, and there's no sense in starting now.
The 68-year-old Mank remembers more snow and colder weather as a kid growing up in the 60s, but he says man-made snow has made a huge difference.
And as soon as the Thanksgiving comes around, the turkey Berkey, we're on the man-made snow, and so we're fortunate to live close to that.
Ben Pop with the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation points out man-made snow loops as he walks past the Berkey Trailhead.
There's upwards of, in some of the places, 2 meters of snow. Other places only have, 2 to 3 feet.
Man-made snow is something Berkey officials hadn't seriously considered until they were forced to call off the race in 2017. Warm weather and rain canceled the event for only the second time in its nearly 50-year run.
The foundation took a real hard look at, okay, what do we have to do with changing climate and the like to really make sure that this always happens? Because it was really devastating to have the race canceled.
The Berkey contributes a roughly $20 million economic impact in the region. Pop says they've spent around $500,000 on snowmaking equipment. He estimates it may cost 4 times that to reach a point where they could hold some sort of race in a year without snow. That may be hard to imagine after 2 feet of snow fell in parts of the region this week, but winter has warmed the most in Wisconsin. That's among findings of the latest report from the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts.
That has been true in the past, and it's expected to be true in the future.
That's Steve Vavris. He's co-director of the initiative and a senior scientist with the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He says the state has grown not just warmer, but wetter.
The 2010s were the second warmest decade on record in Wisconsin, nearly the warmest, and by far the wettest decade going back to the 1800s.
In the winter, precipitation has increased 20% since 1950, and it's falling more often as rain or freezing rain. John McCarthy with Friends of Lapham Peak says that's the trend he's seen at the state park in southeastern Wisconsin.
We get less snow, we get more rain, and when we do get snow, it's followed quickly by a warm-up, and it melted or turned to ice.
Since 2004, he says the nonprofit group has spent more than $1 million on snowmaking for cross-country ski trails there. McCarthy says inconsistent snow makes it difficult to keep members involved with the Peak Ski Club. Jared Johnson with the Ebony Ice Ski Club in Milwaukee says they've also struggled to attract members as the window to hit the slopes has grown shorter in southern Wisconsin. Johnson says warmer weather can create riskier conditions that deter skiers. As ski hills rely more on snowmaking to stay open, he says that can increase costs that may be passed on to visitors and limit access.
It's much more costly to go skiing either locally or out west than it was in the past. And everything increases over time, but it has become almost unaffordable.
As people see less snow or opportunities to ski where they live, Pop says they've seen fewer people from southern Wisconsin take part in the Berkey.
If we do not have infrastructure like that where the people are, so in those population centers, people can't do it.
But he says those opportunities are expanding. He pointed to a Nordic skiing center being built in Brilliant that will offer cross-country skiing and snowmaking. He hopes that and the steps they're taking will allow the next generation of skiers to hit the trails as winters are expected to grow warmer in Wisconsin. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. Now, players on the U.S. women's national soccer team agreed to a $24 million legal settlement this week with the U.S. Soccer Federation, ending a lawsuit over unequal pay. As part of the settlement, U.S. Soccer is agreeing to pay the men's and women's soccer teams equally moving forward. One of the team captains, Megan Rapinoe, told Good Morning America that the settlement will permanently change the landscape of women's soccer.
It's a really amazing day. I think we're going to look back on this day and say this is the moment that U.S. soccer changed for the better. I mean, obviously, we can't go back and undo the injustices that we face. But the only justice coming out of this is that we know that something like this is never going to happen again, and we can move forward and making soccer the best sport that we possibly can in this country, and setting up the next generation so much better than we ever had it.
We're finding out what led to the settlement, what it could mean for equal pay in women's sports, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this lawsuit? Are you glad to hear about the settlement, or do you think it goes far enough? Do you think other sports need more parity, at least in pay, when it comes to men versus women's sports? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Molly Hensley Clancy is a sports investigations reporter for the Washington Post. She's been following this story. Molly, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So for people who haven't been following the lawsuit, can you fill us in on what the team, members of the women's soccer team, were alleging when it comes to unequal pay by the U.S. Soccer Federation?
Yeah, this has been a really long saga. It started back in 2016 when the women filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Basically, the core of their allegations is that the deal that the U.S. Soccer Federation offered to the men allowed them to make substantially more money than the women did. It's complicated, but you know, they said that had they been paid the way that the men were paid, they would have made far, far more money. And that was kind of the core of the allegation. And you also saw them, you know, they were alleging that there were inequalities in the types of fields that they were scheduled to play on, in charter flights. The men even, you know, made more money in per diems for food and things like that than the women did. So that was the core of it.
How large of a role did public pressure play in reaching this settlement? Prominent figures, including President Biden, weighing in over the course of this thing.
I think it played a huge role. A federal judge actually ruled against the women in 2020. So in court, it was very unclear how things would shake out. You know, they'd appealed the case, they'd appealed it in front of the Ninth Circuit, which is obviously somewhat more friendly to liberal or their opinions. But I think that public opinion was always on the women's side for the most part. U.S. soccer was always dealing with criticisms, and they really did not do themselves any favors in kind of how they approached the case. In 2020, they caught a ton of criticism for making legal arguments that said that women athletes were less skilled than men and worked less demanding jobs. And that got them in trouble with the public, but also with their own sponsors. I mean, I think that the pressure from sponsors who, you know, like the women's team, their women's team are a huge part of the reason they choose to sponsor the federation. So to have this fight was not just not good for the public opinion, it was also not something that sponsors were happy with.
Yeah, can you talk about the role of the women's team's success here? You know, there are some sports where men and women in the U.S. do well on international stages. That's not the case here. The women's team, a dominant force in the soccer world. The men's team, is that part of the story? Is that part of why this particular sport can see a settlement like this?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely part of it. I mean, obviously the men's team has been doing better lately. They're sort of seen as a team on the rise, but historically the women have outperformed the men. And for the period of the lawsuit, you had the women winning the World Cup and the men failing to qualify for the World Cup. So the contrast there was just huge. And I think it wasn't solely about on-field performance. I think the on-field performance stuff led to this reality that you know, women's games out-earned men's games for that period. Most of the sort of most familiar, most popular players for U.S. soccer were women. I mean, you saw players like Alex Morgan and Megan Rapinoe, who were just everywhere. Carly Lloyd, compared to men's team players that were maybe not as established, not as, you know, attractive to fans. And so I think that the success really set them up to make this argument that, you know, they brought in more revenue for this time period and that they were more popular than the men's team.
Now, for the Soccer Federation, a lot of times when you settle in a lawsuit, you don't admit that you did anything wrong. You just get it done. What did we hear from the Federation as this settlement was announced?
The Federation announced the settlement alongside the players. So I think that they're really trying to project a united front. They've changed leadership since this all happened. The woman, Cindy Parlow-Cohn, who's the head of the Federation, is actually a former U.S. women's national team player. And she said, you know, that she was the first to admit that the Federation had made mistakes in the past. I think if you look back at the time period where she was playing, the inequalities were even greater. I mean, so she certainly knew what it felt like, what it looked like to be, you know, paid less than the men, treated differently than the men. And so I think that for them, you know, it's not like they were outright admitting, you know, fault, I guess, but they were quite clear that they had seen, you know, they wanted to move forward together with the women's team. And that they had made mistakes. I think that also the amount of the settlement, while it was less than what the women had asked for, it was, you know, seen by many as basically a tacit admission that this discrimination had occurred, that the women were owed back pay.
We're talking to Washington Post reporter Molly Hensley-Clancy about equal pay in women's sports, a legal settlement by the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team and the U.S. Soccer Federation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this soccer story particularly? What do you think of this outcome, this settlement, and acknowledgement that women were underpaid relative to men, at least under the terms of this settlement? Are you hopeful for more equitable pay in the future between men's and women's sports more generally? Do you have questions about this lawsuit settlement? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Molly Hensley-Clancy of the Washington Post about the U.S. Soccer Federation reaching a lawsuit settlement with the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team over unequal pay over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of women's soccer? Are you encouraged by the growth of popularity in the sport? Do you think more equitable pay can help it grow further? Are you a fan of any women's sports team at any level? Are you hoping that there's more prominence for women's sports when it comes to things like media coverage, fan support, and pay? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Molly, this is all going on at the same time as another big story in women's soccer that you've been following, abuse of young women in the sport by coaches longstanding. I believe it was Megan Rapinoe who kind of connected the dots, saying this lack of respect in pay is part of a bigger picture of the treatment of women that led to this abuse. Can you update us on that story?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was the dominant story in women's soccer last year was at least in American women's soccer, was that the National Women's Soccer League was kind of reckoned with this abuse scandal. It was initially professional women's players that spoke up both to me in the Post and in other outlets, saying that they had been verbally and emotionally abused by their coaches. One coach was accused of sexual misconduct with players. It resulted in 5 of the 9 male coaches in the league leaving in just the space of the year amid allegations of misconduct or wrongdoing. And then earlier this year, I also reported that one of those coaches had been accused of sexual misconduct with young players, with youth players back in the 90s. So it really, you know, has put together this picture of the way women are treated in American soccer. And there's a long way to go. I think Megan Rapinoe told me, you know, this is just the beginning. And getting equal pay is just one of the things we're fighting for. And they've very had some very strong words for U.S. soccer about their failures to stop coaching abuse, to protect young players from abusive coaches, protect them from abusive coaches.
As you mentioned, this was a break. I believe you broke the story last year. What is the current state of affairs when it comes to looking into the allegations we know about and seeing if this is more common in women's soccer than we might have hoped?
There's quite a few investigations. I think the most major one is an investigation that U.S. Soccer opened into themselves, but it's being done by Sally Q. Gates, the former acting attorney general. And so she's currently in the middle of that investigation. The league is also doing its own investigation. You have FIFA looking into it. So there's a lot going on right now. I'm still, you know, looking into it as well. So I think that it's a story that's going to continue to develop, and you're going to see players really hold U.S. Soccer and hold the National Women's Soccer League accountable. U.S. Soccer oversaw the Professional Women's League for almost a decade during the time that most of these abuses happened. So it certainly played a substantial role in what unfolded in the league.
We're talking to Molly Hensley-Clancy, sports investigations reporter at the Washington Post, looking at a legal settlement between the U.S. Soccer Federation and the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, a payout acknowledging unequal pay over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. To me, this is an issue of equal pay for equal value, like any employee of any company. And I don't know the answer to this question, but does women's soccer draw the same number of fans who pay the same ticket prices when they go to a game? And the television contracts, do they have the same value of the television contracts? And if the answer is yes, then by all means, equal pay. But if the answer is no, I don't see how you can justify equal pay because they don't have the same value.
Mark, thanks for the call. Molly, I guess the answer might be different if we're looking at, you know, the individual pro teams around the country versus the national team. What is the picture?
So it depends on what years you're looking at, but for the years that are covered in this lawsuit, the women's team actually out-earned the men in their games. In terms of television contracts, U.S. Soccer bundles those together. So it's, you can't really tell, you know, who watches or who draws what numbers or what revenue from television contracts. We do know that the Women's World Cup games drew, you know, similar viewers. I mean, they certainly drew more viewers in 2015 in the U.S. than the Men's World Cup because the men, you know, weren't playing. So I think that it does absolutely matter, the revenue. That was part of the women's argument, that they brought in more money than the men's team did for this time period. It, you know, overall, the men did out-earn them over, you know, decades. And I'll also note that U.S. Soccer Federation is actually a nonprofit. It's not a for-profit company. So I think that, you know, their mission is to promote soccer in the United States. And so you can't purely look at revenue because what the national teams are not just there to bring in money. They're also there to promote the game, get young people interested in the game, and you know, make appearances on television and all those kinds of things. So that there's multiple pieces of it. It's certainly more complicated than revenue and you know, who brought in more money.
Thanks for that call, Mark, at 800-642-1234. I know we're focusing on soccer here, Molly. Is there any thought that this settlement might have ripple effects into other women's sports?
I think that the U.S. women's national team was in a pretty unique situation because of, again, the fact that they had been out-earning the men for that period because of their success. But I do think that overall you see women, a real moment for women's sports. There's, you know, a huge investment that was recently announced in the WNBA. And I think that, you know, for women's soccer globally, this will certainly be kind of a rallying point for other women's teams to, you know, we've already seen other women's teams in Australia, in other places push for something close to equal pay. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that while the U.S. women were kind of uniquely situated in terms of being able to make this argument, because it's likely that we see, you know, more and more women's teams being able to, you know, make similar points about the value they're bringing.
Now, this is the national team level. I think I've seen some of the players involved in the settlement say something like FIFA next, FIFA being the governing body for soccer around the world. A former director there, I think, drew controversy for saying that, women players should wear shorter skirts or something along those lines. Is that an even bigger challenge than the national team might have been?
Yeah, FIFA is huge. FIFA is global. Right now, the disparities in prize money between the men's and the women's tournaments are massive. Of course, there are disparities in, who watches the men's tournament compared to the women. You know, the men currently bring in substantially more viewers. However, I think if you look at it, the amount of men's prize money, many people would argue, is disproportionate even to that. And I think that from FIFA, what Megan Rapinoe and others, many other people have been asking for is more equal investment, not just kind of equal pay. That, maybe right now you can't, well, you could, because FIFA's a nonprofit as well, but you may not be ready to completely equalize prize money yet because of the difference in viewers. But, there should be a far bigger investment in women's soccer globally from FIFA, because again, their mission is to promote the game.
Molly, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Molly Hensley-Clancy is a sports investigations reporter for The Washington Post. She was with us today for a look at the equal pay lawsuit settlement between the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team and the U.S. Soccer Federation. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Hey, Wisconsin, you like cheese? We've got a guest who really likes cheese with an almost, maybe even equally religious fervor. We'll find out why, learn some of the surprising history behind cheese, and get lots of advice on cheeses to try, how to store and serve them, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some global military and political leaders say Russia's invasion of Ukraine has brought an end to the post-Cold War era. We'll talk to a historian about what that means and what could come next. Now, for this week's edition of Food Friday, we're going to Cheese Church. Our guest treats cheese like her religion. She's a cheese expert who wants to share her wisdom and love of cheese with the world, and maybe convince you that if you don't like blue cheese, it's just because maybe you haven't met the right one yet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite cheese of all time? Any recommendations for Wisconsin cheeses or cheese pairings? What do you want to know about fancy cheese and how to give it a try? And if there's cheese makers out there, love to hear from you about the secrets of cheese making and what drew you into it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Erica Kubik is a former cheesemonger and the author of Cheese, Sex, Death, a Bible for the Cheese Obsessed. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you get obsessed with cheese, Erica?
I mean, the same way anyone else does. It and fell in love. I mean, the real story is for a big part of my adolescence, I was a vegetarian, so I didn't love vegetables at the time. So I was eating a ton of cheese. My big cheese awakening was actually with a Wisconsin cheese, Sarvecchio from Sartori. It's in Plymouth, Wisconsin. My mom ended up I feel like I was 13. She got it at the farmer's market and brought home a 2-pound chunk of it. And I mean, me and my dad destroyed that chunk within probably a week. I mean, if I'm being honest, probably in 2 days. It's still one of my favorite cheeses. I love that it has notes of pineapple in it, but it's really creamy and it just melts in your mouth. It's such a delicious cheese.
Executive producer Dean Knetter, also a former cheesemonger, has that exact make and model in his fridge right now. He lets me know. That's fantastic. Now you approach this with a religious fervor, and your book is laid out like a Bible. And I learned you're not the first. Cheese has played a big role in religious traditions going back thousands of years. Can you talk about that a little?
Oh, absolutely. That was one of the most exciting things that I discovered while writing this book. My research really started with this incredible book called Cheese and Culture by Paul Kinstead. He's a Vermonter, but his book is really fabulous. And he writes all about the history of cheese and human civilization. So actually back in ancient Mesopotamia with the ancient Sumer cult, the religion and a lot of their gods, that's one of the beginnings of cheese and religion. So back like at the beginning of when they were developing like their first writing, one of the ways they did that was by actually taking account of the inventory that was going into their religious temples. So they were giving this cheese as offerings to their gods and writing about the cheeses that were there just to help them keep track. That actually really did help with developing writing skills too. So I think as a cheese writer, I think that's pretty awesome that those all go hand in hand. But the ancient goddess Inanna, which is like the goddess of love and sex, she was like the precursor to Aphrodite and Venus. She actually demanded offerings of cheese. So I'm a huge fan of her. Love Inanna.
And it shows up in Christian traditions. You write that sometimes the host is replaced bread, no, cheese in. You have quotes from St. Benedict in his setting things up for monastic orders. Totally. With the notes on how to make cheese.
Yeah, there's actually an ancient Christian cult that actually put cheese in the Eucharist instead of bread. The Roman Catholic Church was not a huge fan of that. They ended up like, they were like, you guys can't do it. It's too close to pagans, so we're not allowing it. But it did happen. I just think that's so cool, so fascinating. And I mean, the Greeks they definitely used cheese as a bloodless sacrifice to their gods as well. There's a lot of instances of cheese and religion being together.
Let's get into eating cheese now. As much as I love the history here, there's a lot of kind of cheese out there. There's a lot of great cheddar. You reference Wisconsin cheddar in your book, a lot of variety there. But you talk about some great ways to maybe venture out into those fancier cheeses that we might be intimidated by. How do we start to check those out?
For me, I think the best way to do that is to talk to a cheesemonger. They know so much about the cheeses that they have, but they also know how to guide you. So my biggest recommendation is to basically figure out what your favorite cheese is. What is the one that you always go to, that you always gravitate to? And then ask a cheesemonger, what is something that's similar to this so I can try something new, but I already know that I'm going to like it. And they're so happy to guide you.
We're talking to Erica Kubik on this edition of Food Friday. She loves cheese. She's the author of the book Cheese, Sex, Death, a Bible for the Cheese Obsessed. Got a website of the same name. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a cheese you love to share with the world? A favorite way to find a good cheese, a favorite way to cook with cheese or serve it, maybe on a cheese board. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. By the way, you can also go to WPR.org/Food Friday for a couple of recipes from Erica. And let's check one of those out now, Erica. A garlic honey baked brie. Sounds fantastic. Can you tell us about it?
So good. Yeah, you know, it's very simple. I love baking brie. It's just this really quick way to just get something hot and gooey and so satisfying, so seductive. I like that recipe a lot because I didn't just go the sweet or the savory route. I went with both. So you start out by like mincing garlic and then sticking, like putting like a cross, you basically carve a crosshatch into the cheese and then stuff the little slits with garlic covered in honey, and a little bit of rosemary. And then you just bake it and it comes out and you dip some bread into it. It's really quick, so easy. It's really all about getting a good brie, but it's endlessly delicious. I love the combination of rosemary, garlic, and honey.
Sounds fantastic. Check that recipe out at WPR.org/Food Friday. And that reminds me, Erica, talking about the temperature of cheese. You've got a lot of great advice on appreciating cheese, storing, and more. Let's start with temperature. Are all cheeses better at, you know, room temperature or warmer? Or are some fine to yank out of the fridge and start eating like I tend to do?
So The real answer is you always want to serve a cheese at room temperature. Refrigeration dulls the flavor, so you don't get all the complexities. It can also make the texture more brittle. So if you have like an ooey gooey, like perfectly ripened brie style cheese and you eat that right out of the refrigerator, it's going to be very firm, like the texture of cold butter. I mean, it's like butter, right? Like when you go to a restaurant and you have a softened butter and you get to spread that on a piece of bread, like that's so fun. But if it's really firm and you're just kind of dragging it along and like ruin the texture of the bread in the process, it's not as palatable, it's not as enjoyable, it doesn't have like that sensuous texture. However, all of that being said, that is the correct answer. I actually really love to eat blue cheese right out of the fridge. For me, the texture just, it feels like ice cream. It's so good. But you know, blue cheese is also really strong, so dulling the flavor of it isn't as big of a deal. If you aren't looking for like that crazy in your face, like punchy funk. So, I mean, you should definitely temper your cheese, but I'm guilty of that sin as well.
That's cheese in the fridge. Now you talk about something I never even thought about doing, freezing cheese. I guess that's a question you get sometimes. Should we freeze cheese?
No. My opinion is you absolutely should not. Freezing cheese alters the chemistry of the cheese. So the liquid inside of it will crystallize. There's a little bit of separation that happens. There are some exceptions to that rule. In my experience, fresh goat cheese actually freezes really well. I'm sure there's something to do with the science and the chemistry behind it that I don't quite understand. Also, if you're planning to cook with the cheese, so if you have like a grated semi-firm like Colby Jack or something like that, it's probably not as big of a deal if you freeze it. I've done it and it's turned out okay. But if you have a beautiful piece of cheese that you want to put on a cheese plate, do not freeze. You're totally going to change the flavor, the texture. It's really going to hurt the cheese. You just don't want to do it. You want to experience it in its full glory, you know?
And then there's cheese buying logistics. And you have strong feelings about this. If we have a decision between I'm going to stock up on a whole lot of cheese now versus a steady cheese flow, which way do we go?
Steady cheese flow all the way. The thing is, cheese, it's sensitive, right? It needs the right temperature, the right humidity to stay healthy. The best way to make sure the cheese stays healthy is to make sure it stays in the cheese shop until you are ready to eat it, because the cheesemonger is going to take much better care of it. If you buy like a small piece of cheese and you let it sit in your fridge, I mean, I think we're all guilty of doing that sometimes. We just forget that we bought so much cheese and it can dry out. It can lose a lot of its flavor. I mean, cheese starts to go bad as soon as it's cut from the wheel. So it's better to let it get cut from the wheel from a cheesemonger and then eat it as soon as possible and then go back and buy more cheese. I would never tell somebody to buy less cheese. You should buy it more often in less quantities when you do buy it.
We're talking to Erica Kubik, former cheesemonger, author of the book Cheese, Sex, Death, a Bible for the cheese obsessed. She likes cheese. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like cheese? Do you love cheese? What are your go-to everyday eaten cheeses? Do you have some for special occasions? Are you afraid of stinky cheese or do you love it? If you love it, how'd you get into it? If you make cheese, love to hear from you if you're not too busy making cheese right now. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And don't forget, find a couple recipes from Erica at wpr.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with the cheese preacher, Erica Kubik. Her new book is Cheese, Sex, Death, a Bible for the Cheese Obsessed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself obsessed with cheese? What is your favorite kind of cheese to eat? Have you met a cheese you don't like, or do you love them all? Do you have a recipe to share or a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Butch is with us in Broadhead. Butch, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about?
So I wanted to just share that I love sharp cheddar. Extra sharp is too sharp. Cheddar is too blasé, but I could eat it every day. But I also wanted to share that I was asked at a small bar in Albany if I wanted toast, buttered toast with my Limburger, and I'm here to tell you, it makes the Limburger so much better, and I do not eat onion with my Limburger.
Now, there's, I mean, that's, I, as a kid, I watched the cartoons and the Limburger and the smell. How strong was the smell, Butch, when you were eating it on the toast at the bar?
It's less strong, but you, like they say at Baumgartner's, you don't eat it with your nose. So if you smell that cheese, you're not going to eat it.
Butch, thanks a lot for the call. Eric, I've been thinking of asking you about Limburger because it gets this bad reputation from the cartoons of my childhood.
Yeah, I actually really love Limburger. It was my grandfather. My grandfather's from Wisconsin. It was his absolutely favorite cheese. I always had to hunt it down and find it for him. It can be kind of tricky to find nowadays. It is, I mean, it can range in the amount that it smells, but some of those blocks are borderline offensive. However, I wanted to comment on the butter trick. That's actually one of my favorite tricks for a cheese that's feeling a little bit too intense. If you add a little bit of butter to it, that extra fat helps carry that flavor across your palate. So it's just like a lot less punchy, you know? I love putting butter on Limburger. I love butter with blue cheese. As far as with the Limburger, I do love to eat it with some red onions.
Butch, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erica, he also mentioned his favorite sharpness level of cheddar. He said he likes sharp, extra sharp is too much, medium, not sharp enough. My kids, good Wisconsin kids, they'd get the oldest cheddar I'd be willing to fork out the money for. Do you have preferred cheddar levels?
Oh yeah, definitely. I like it pretty sharp. I mean, for me, it's really less about sharpness and more about age. I love when it gets a little bit crumbly, it gets a little bit of those like crunchy crystals. Cheese crystals in it. That, yeah, exactly. That's when it almost like crumbles apart. That's the kind of cheddar I love.
Now you've got another recipe for us. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now we love cheese balls here in Wisconsin and everything bagel. Goat cheese ball. How do we make these at home?
Oh, it's so easy. It's so good. So I have, I think there's three cheeses in the cheese ball. It's fresh goat cheese. So delicious. It's also coming into fresh goat cheese season. Mascarpone. You can use cream cheese if you want. I like the like fluffiness of mascarpone though. And then some cheddar, just shred it up in there. You mix it with some chives or some other little fun stuff in there. Then it's so easy. You roll it into a ball, chill it. Cover with everything seasoning. It's really, I absolutely love an everything bagel with chive cream cheese. So this is, I love this recipe. It's so good. I serve it all the time. I think it's probably my most used recipe among my followers as well.
Find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. It is Food Friday. We're talking to Erica Kubik, author of Cheese, Sex, Death. Talking about her great love of cheese, she's sharing it, plus lots of advice. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234 if you have a favorite cheese to share with us. I mean, literally, if you want to bring some in, but you can also just tell us about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Erica, I teased something. Better get back to it before we run out of time. Blue cheese, a lot of people might think they don't like it. You say maybe they just haven't met the right one yet. Why is that?
You know, there's just such a range in blue cheese. And I think a lot of times people will, their only experience with it is like crumbled on a salad or something like that. Sometimes when you get blue cheese on a salad, it's already pre-crumbled, which means it has to be mixed with something in order to keep it in that texture and preserve it longer. I just think it's such a shame that people will write it off so quickly. So I actually recommend, we talked about, a little bit about this before, adding some butter to it. I just piece of baguette, put some butter on there, put the blue cheese on that. And if you want, you can even add a little bit of honey to help marry all of those flavors together. That extra fat really just goes a long way to kind of minimize the punch of funk in the blue cheese. I also recommend trying different blue cheeses. I really love Buttermilk Blue from Roth in Wisconsin. I think it's got a great tanginess to it. It's also relatively mild. So that's a really good one to start with. Another good trick is to eat it cold from the fridge because refrigeration does dull the flavor of a cheese. So if you are a little bit afraid of the flavor, then that's actually a good thing if you're trying to acclimate your palate to enjoy blue cheese.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Danny is on the line in Madison. Danny, hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about, Danny?
I wanted to get the author's opinion on, it's not a Wisconsin one. I love Wisconsin cheese, but a real Parmesan, so Parmigiano Reggiano, like the aged one that almost tastes more like a meat than a cheese.
Yeah, Danny, thanks for that. Erica, what do you think?
Parmigiano Reggiano is one of my very favorite cheeses of all time. I think it's absolutely perfect. It's known as the king of cheese, and for a good reason. It's regal. It's so incredibly delicious. It has some of the most intense flavors, and also it's just such a joy to eat texture-wise. I love just like chunking off little crumbles of it. Sometimes I just eat it with olive oil and balsamic. Sometimes I just eat it straight off the block. It's also one of the best cheeses to pair with wine. When I was developing the pairing section of the book, I wanted to figure out like what are all the best go-to wine and cheese pairings. And every single time I would try a wine with Parmigiano, every single thing went. It was crazy. It was white wines, red wines, rosés, orange wines. There was never a wine that didn't love a Parmigiano Reggiano.
Danny, it's a crazy. Thanks a lot for that, Danny. We'll go to Diane now in Darlington. Diane, hi.
Hi. So my father-in-law, he had a really good friend named Johnny Boosman, who was a cheesemaker in Lena, and he made a cheese called Applejack, and he would always bring us a chunk of cheese, and that's my favorite cheese now.
And is that just what it sounds like, Monterey Jack, with what, apple flavor, apple chunks? How does that work, Diane? I haven't had this.
I don't know exactly. I do know that when he retired, he sold his recipe, and it's currently made. It's still in Lena. It's wonderful melted, so I like to melt some, saute some zucchini with onion and some butter and throw some Applejack on there. And when it melts, it kind of gets sweet. It's wonderful.
I love it, Diane. Thanks a lot for that. Erica, do you have a favorite melting cheese?
Totally. It's Gruyere. It has to be a young Gruyere. It's, you know, it's the classic. It's one of the oldest cheeses. And it just melts like such a dream. I also love that it has a little bit of like a nutty, slightly meaty flavor to it. It goes really well in so many recipes. I mean, grilled cheese, fondue. I've even put it on pizza before. Yeah, it's got to be Gruyere.
Aha. Okay. We've got Vern's cheese, Applejack cheese, named after the apple River Dairy, where it was created, does not actually contain or taste like apples. Thanks for producers for checking that out for me. Well, Erica, we just have a couple minutes left. What are the frontiers of your cheese research / obsession right now? What are you obsessing on?
Yeah, obsessing with. You know, it changes every day. I would say that because we're going into spring, that is goat cheese season. So I'm definitely cooking with goat cheese right now. I'm eating it just by the tub full. I really can't get enough of it, but spring is the best time for goat cheese because that's kidding season. It's also when the grass starts growing. So basically, once the mama goats give birth to their babies, very soon after that, they start lactating, start giving their milk, which means cheese making starts. Because fresh goat cheese is fresh, it doesn't need to age. That very quickly turns into cheese. But they're also the mama goats are out on pasture now, so they're out eating the fresh first blades of spring, and the way that the flavors of like the first juicy blades of grass in the springtime, like the way that translates into the milk and eventually into the cheese, I mean, ugh, it's just delightful.
Okay, I'm in. What's your favorite way to serve up goat cheese to yourself and others?
You know, that's such an impossible question to answer. There's always so many different types or different ways of serving it. Right now, I love some toasted sourdough with just like a bunch of fresh goat cheese on there. Put it on like when the toast is still warm so that it just spreads and kind of melts into the bread a little bit. And then I love orange marmalade on top. It's just to die for.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Always down to talk cheese.
Erica Kubik is a cheese expert and big fan of cheese. She talked to us about her book. It's called Cheese, Sex, Death, a Bible for the Cheese Obsessed. Find a couple recipes from Erica over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Pretty straightforward ones. Easy to make this weekend if you'd like. And there's still time for you to share your personal cheese obsession or obsessions. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know your favorite cheese and how you like to eat it. Or you could post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. It's been a busy week in the state capital, even if it's been overshadowed by international news. Check out a flurry of activity in the closing days in the state legislative session. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Here's some follow-up from last week's edition of Food Friday. I talked to a co-author of the book Food IQ, who had lots of very practical advice for cooking. You shared some of your advice on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's a couple. Curtis says, if the eggs look done in the pan, they will be overcooked on the plate. I've been there, man. And just because, Curtis says, you take something off the stove or out of the oven, it doesn't mean it stops cooking. Curtis says, I think Alton Brown calls this carryover cooking or something similar to that. And Brandy writes, have all your ingredients ready. Mix your dry ingredients, then mix your wets, then mix them together, then cook. Brandy says, I can follow recipes now. I wish I knew more about flavors so I can make my own stuff. My worst story with that, I was baking something where I knew I was going to use applesauce, didn't get my ingredients ready first, pulled the applesauce out of the fridge halfway through. It was old. It was moldy. I had to change the recipe halfway through. It still came out okay, but good advice, Brandy. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.